We're trying to very shortly summarize the sound points in our course in order to facilitate your dealing with exams. I'm absolutely sure that you will pass all of them. And they said, don't worry about that, it's absolutely insignificant business. But I would recommend all of you still to attend his coaching sessions. Would you please kindly remind me the date of your exam?
That's 31st.
Excellent. So we still have how many?
3 days.
No, I mean, no, 3 more courses.
Yeah.
What day of the week is your exam?
Tuesday.
So please try to be as attentive as possible, because it is for your own good that I decided to make the exam. Sort of revision point, lessons. It is entirely in your interest, not in mine, because to me it's extremely boring to repeat what I have already done. And it is being done exclusively in your interest and for your own sake. I hate repeating what I have already said, all the more so that you read part one. One very formal advice. There are a lot of you who try to read last year's exam questions. To read last year's exam questions is as useless as say, before getting married, to read a lot of novels and short stories. Well, why? Because such thing as experience is, as Krishna said to Arjuna, inexpressible. You have your experience, but you cannot learn it the way you learn numbers and economics. Now I would like to return very shortly to some points with which we practically started our course in the autumn, last autumn, that is the Mahabharata and some topics related to its content. First of all, I would like to remind you that prior to starting thinking of the Mahabharata, you have to bear in mind its character as a text. It is, in a way, a unique text of its own. I try to tell you, using some examples from other cultures which may well be nearer to your understanding and closer to your own background. The background of this class is, I must say, very bluntly, including my own. Well, we know that the Mahabharata is a kind of treasury of myth, folklore, philosophy. A very, at the same time, artistic knowledge, poet, God knows what. The number of plots and subplots in the Mahabharata is immense. As I have already told you, it is a kind of a library more than a book. At the same time, it is a book, not a library. Why? Because not only is and was it perceived as one book, but it was gradually created as one book. All those notions are merely formal, such notions as a book, a story, a novel. They belong to our idea of genre. And that is why what we call a book within the framework and context of European culture is one. Or what they called a book or even a text is quite another. For instance, you may go to Dillon's and buy a book, Irish or Celtic Folklore, containing 156 various stories. I adore Celtic folklore. It is a collection. It is a collection of specimens. It was not meant by those who sang it, or recited, or even read it. It was not meant to be one book. It was artificially collected, edited, explained, and published by Brothers Rees or any other great investigators of Celtic. Like any anthology say Oxford Anthology of British Verse, yes, or Edinburgh Anthology of Scottish Verse. We may say that its content is extremely variegated. We do not know how many authors, and I do not know what took place in its creation, composition, arrangement, rearrangement. But in the case of Mahabharata, it simply doesn't matter. Why? Because Mahabharata is given to us within the framework of a certain tradition within which it was regarded as one. And when we start investigating any literary source, our first point of view in our investigation must be what? The point of view of those who created that source. And those who perceive that source, not our own analytical and clever scholarly judgment. It must have something. You understand this? So according to the Mahabharata itself, it was one book. Yes, gigantic book. The largest, the biggest book in the world history. Still one book. Now, very shortly,
of its own. It is a very serious problem. Never forget that that water in single quartz is an idea. There are a lot of cultures where that idea is not yet absent. In the sense that, well, it doesn't matter who sang it, who decided it, who wrote it, and then we may put in brackets, thirst. It's very Judeo-Christian, it's very European, very Mediterranean. In fact, in ancient India, the idea of the thirst in Sindhu was totally absent. Again, it did not matter because there were no thirsts. Why? Now, try to understand it, because it is not that easy. What really matters if who did it didn't matter. What really matters is not who, but what. The event and its awareness, which was conveyed through hundreds, if not thousands, of narrations and sub-narrations in the Mahabharata. And my impression is, not only my impression, is also one by an impression, though formulated, worded in a quite different way from mine, but my impression is that the book was, as it were, gradually, naturally created. Because when somebody started reading it aloud, there was no writing at that time, don't forget about that, you cannot even that he started doing that. It was in the background. So, doors, bars, as any other bars, they were, none of them was primary. You cannot say, oh well, there was one bard in the 9th century BC who started singing the great battle of the Mahabharata and its heroes. No, it is impossible to say that. Because the primary fact was not the an author, or a bard, or a singer, or a brahman, yes, or a kshatriya. The primary source was what? The tradition. You cannot write, or sing, or recite that which had not been there. That was not first, you understand this? The first was what? Event. Event which was its own author. I know it is a matter. Still, you cannot say who did it. Who did it first? My impression is, and it is confirmed by some Indologists far more, infinitely far more knowledgeable than I am. I'm no philologist at all. But my impression is that we simply have to reject from the very start the idea of ownership. In this sense, even more than that, Mahabharata itself, on which we have to rely, says that it was retold, yes, by the great Vyasa, various heroes. So, the events described in the Mahabharata, yes, and they communicated them to one another. And the great Teller, the great Rishi, Vyasa, and his associates, yes, his pupils, they were simply, well, returning, combining the work probably continued for at least 20 generations.
Yes, it was life of tradition,
which finally became that which we now call the book, that is, the Mahabharata, because there was no other. You understand that? It's a very important point. And there is one other very interesting point concerning the authorship, again, non-existing in that civilization at that time. The point is that it was very often the habit. If I sing a text or recite a text, as a lot of people did in ancient Norway, in ancient southern Germany, Sweden, Iceland, etc., the great bards of the Viking period, who were invited to wedding ceremonies, to other festivities, yes, where they recited and sang their ballads and legends and everything, very often in India particularly, where there was no idea of authorship, those who did it called themselves by mythic names of their predecessors. So their own name practically played no role. That is why, in fact, we see no names of the great ones, because they were orators, because they were no authors at all. This is not to say, of course, that there was never the idea of authorship in ancient India. It appeared. It appeared somewhere again. Within that crucial period of 5th, 6th, 4th century, but you know, the Mahabharata descended to us from far greater antiquity, but as plot and intention and great tradition, not as a ready, completed book, which it became probably somewhere between the 1st century BC and the 1st century AD. And in saying this, of course, I would never exclude any reduction, revision, transformation, interpolation. No, everything was there, but not in our, because all of them, they worked within the same tradition and were totally alien to such literary ideas of our time as plagiarism, distortion, misinterpretation, etc. There are a lot of contradictory points of view in the Mahabharata on the same subject. Why? Because such was one. Why? Because tradition allowed them to be expressed. It was living tradition. Whose life, as I said, stopped when finally it became a book. And they drew the line. No more additions, no more revisions, no more reductions. The most interesting moment in this was that it indeed took a lot of time, as I said, say, some 20 generations.
And after that, tradition continued, but in a different way, based on a quite definite, completed, and standardized text,
after which followed what? The period of its grammar of what? Put into writing in various traditions, and then it spread through other local traditions, Brahmanical and non-Brahmanical.
It's, shall we say, fractioning. Some parts of it were practically made a kind of new sacred text, while on the whole, according to the tradition, Mahabharata never was a sacred text. It was itihasa, it was a narration.
And in quite a few traditions, it became the main sacred text, particularly such parts thereof as the Bhagavad Gita and the Anugita and the Moksha Dharma, etc. Speaking of that natural process subsequent to the completion of the complete text of the Mahabharata, it was various versions of it, various recensions of it were sung, recited, and written in at least 26 languages and dialects of India in quite different variants. Religious sectarian milieus having nothing to do with initial great tradition to which the Mahabharata attributed itself. Is it understandable? Yes? Remember it for your good reasons. There was probably a time within the time of there was probably a time when give me matches, please, or light. When speaking of books, thank you very much. Speaking of books within a given tradition, the Mahabharata was indeed the only book. It was the book with capital B. And why? It's a very interesting question. In order to understand it, we have to return to the idea of text in ancient India, oral text. Practically, all texts of ancient all politics of Vietnam. All texts of ancient India belong to one or another tradition. More than that, the very idea of very complex, differentiated, and contentful, so to speak, full of its content. It was very tricky. Why? Look, It was somewhere, probably in the second or the third, I'm inclined to think the second, not any earlier, century BC, when we see that formal traditional division into Smriti and Shruti. Smriti is what?
Remembered.
Remembered. Shruti.
To be heard.
Heard. Heard. What does it mean? Heard. From the source. What does it mean? The source. And heard from the divine source, supernatural. About some events and some persons, some heroes, some wise men, I remember, and I continue that remembrance in generations to come. If I am a guru, through my pupils, who in their turn become gurus and etc. Nevertheless, there is a reference to those who may well heard it as it were. First, because I'm referring to them. We may say, well, there were no authors in the Mahabharata, but there was one person who was retelling it, Vyasa. Vyasa must have been a very busy man to retell rendering it into English language around something like 12,000 pages. But you may say, well, it is nonsense. I'm not saying that there was such a person as he is. I am not saying that he retold 10,000 pages. It doesn't matter. But he was referred to as a person who did it. And the bards who were singing for 20 generations various parts of that book when it had not yet become a complete book. We were always referring to him, not as an author, but as a narrator. Yes. Okay. That is plain and easily understandable. But the idea, the mighty idea was not only that the person, Vyasa, retold all that stuff, but that by means natural as well as supernatural, he knew perfectly well what he was retelling, what he was narrating. You understand this? It's, in our culture, it is non-essential. Why? We say, well, this is a historical composition or an article or an investigation or monograph, and that is a fiction. Yes? Why? Because the genres have already been find in our culture. Of course, let me tell you, there have been a lot of curious things at the beginning of our century. One person wrote a book about big American family. Yes, absolutely meticulously registered the life of that family, not only from a positive side, but from a negative side too. And of course,
he was immediately under threat of what?
Prosecution.
For libel and the defamation.
Yes.
He was a poor man and very witty. And he said, no, it's your mistake. It is a novel. You know, I forgot the name of this famous lawyer in Great Britain now. Very popular person. Great show. Very clever man. Who now deals with such things, because you can write whatever you want. But call it a fiction, yes? It is those idiots who made that film, what is it? In the name of
the power
of the Father. Absolute idiots. That why they preserved some real names. Mm-hmm. From my point of view, each and every director or film scriptwriter is in his absolute right to do what he or she wants. Yes? But they still quite idiotically called some people by their names and then immediately said, oh, no, that man never said that, you know, because the public in general is, however stupid some writers and film directors might be, public in general is far more stupid because it is public. Yes, every mass phenomenon is idiotic, you know that, yes. Because there is no collective mind. Mind can be only individual. Even the stupidest individual person is much cleverer than two clever persons taken together with one opinion. I am certainly sure of it. But it's my personal opinion. Do not quote me in your exam papers. Yes. Anyway, what is very interesting, he won the court case. And but why all that wasn't still is possible? Because we are living in the culture where the genres are defined, however formally they are defined. Of course, it would be a kind of a bad joke if I call my lecture today a poem.
Yes.
It would be. Still, I will ask my very good Scottish friend, who is a great versificator, to make it in a sort of rhythmic prose. And then it can be passed for a kind of free, kind of the freest possible variable. It's of tremendously bad quality, of course, but it doesn't matter. Still, it is very important. At that time, there were no genres. Narration was narration. The most important was what of the text? What is narrated? And, well, there are some not very clever Indian historians who repeat their stance. Probably you read about that the Mahabharata shows the process of the struggle between Kshatriyas and Brahmins, and the final form of the Mahabharata reflects the victory, the Brahmanical victory and defeat of the Kshatriyas. Well, no, it is a normal example of historical stupidity, because what we deal with in the Mahabharata, we deal with the text as it is, and nothing else. And the division of several pieces, well, in terms of Brahmanical or Kshatriya ideology is possible, but never from the very start. You cannot start with it. I would like now to return to that narration. You know, listen, somewhere in the middle of the
first millennium BC, it was quite possibly to a bard or a couple of bards to recite the whole of the Mahabharata. Of course, it became more difficult when the text was orally completed. When I say completed, I mean again orally completed. Why? Because it was a huge text. Let me tell you one moment. One standard typed page now, by BBC standards, can be read in 2 minutes. Yes. Say 10,000 standard pages means 20,000 minutes. Yes. Well, but I do not think that the bards recited and sang the Mahabharata with the tempo of the BBC reading, shall we say 30,000 minutes. Do divide them by 60 and you will have what? A miserable 500 hours. Usually narration performance lasted approximately 10 to 15 hours a day. Yes, they were patient people. It was the greatest pleasure to sit what? On the ground with their families, with food, yes, with milk, with juice, and listen to narration. Is well, shall we say, 500 hours. Well, it is something like, what today's? Very interesting days. In my opinion, even that was possible. More than that, if you ask me whether it was possible to a person to recite or sing, 10,000 objective typed pages by heart, by memory, let me tell you it was possible. And it cannot be possible. Because there was not one bard in India, in North India at that time. There were hundreds of bards. And to satisfy, shall we say, the cultural, in single words, needs of population, yes. And it was a culture of memorization, of remembering, of recollection, of singing, and of reciting. And let me tell you one thing, which is very important in this connection. Our European culture, and not only our European culture, ancient Babylonian culture, practically all ancient Semitic cultures, apart from ancient Jews who were not terribly prone to write all the time, it started much later, mania of writing in Jews, yes. But then they simply could not stop writing, yes. But after that, but in the ancient world, Egyptians, they wrote bloody all the time. And when you write, your motivation, your intention is totally different from that which was dominant in the oral tradition. To memorize is that which is opposed to write. You understand this? Opposed not only in terms of concrete, as it were, physical labor, but in terms of inner psychological attention. Those who write have no need to remember. You understand this? Because it is here, it's on the shelves, yes? And of course it goes without saying, those who remember, they do not need to write. It's two different kinds of energy. Let me, in order to make it more understandable, let me give you one in my opinion, very funny example. There was one German philosopher, mathematician, scholar, commentator, philologist, linguist, natural scientist, and everything else, whose name was Leibniz. You heard of him, yes? And when his archive, of course, he wrote with his pen, when his archive was classified and catalogized, the work which took approximately 5 generations of German scholars, yes, the archive produced by one man, can you imagine? They came to conclusion that no, it was impossible for one person to have written all this. It was physically impossible. So I read an article where it was written in black and white that to a normal person to copy what Leibniz wrote, to copy, not to invent, but to copy, would take approximately 125 days of absolutely mad, devilish work. All the more so, because recently it was established that it was not all his archive, but a great cupboard was drowned during his travel through Baltic Sea to St. Petersburg. Yes? So it was his archive minus one big cupboard. Yes. Full of manuscripts. From my point of view, my approach to this poor man, I hate writing. Yes. If I write one page per day, I feel a sick and finished man. I'm empty. Yes. But mind it, in parallel to what I've already said about the Mahabharata, why it is so with me? I'm a talking person. Mm-hmm. I talk. Those who talk a lot, usually useless, yes. They cannot write a lot. There are some exceptions, but very few. My motivation is different. And when I write, I simply, usually, mentally copy what I talk. You understand this? So it is a different matter, which Leibniz never did. He was talking, he was a great man, he was a genius. He was talking very, very little, like he's a great rival and arch enemy, who? Isaac Newton. Well, Isaac Newton. So from his point of view, all people around him were totally hopeless and stupid. There was no reason for them. So he wrote. Yes, he wrote a lot too, but much less than Leibniz. Let us return to yes. I'm not saying that I believe that Vyasa, traditionally speaking, knew the whole Mahabharata by heart. But from my point of view, it is quite possible, absolutely possible, particularly when I met a couple of Tibetan chaps from Ladakh, and one of which knew by heart around 50,000 pages of Buddhist canonical texts. Yes. And I personally know one Jewish chap from Haifa, who knows by heart the whole Talmud, all additional commentaries, not to speak of Tanakh, which makes good 15,000-16,000 pages. By heart. In this respect, it would be very, he is a genius of memory, and then you may ask me immediately, well, with Leibniz it is okay, with Vyasa it is okay. But why that Jewish chap? Or why that Tibetan chap from Ladakh, yes? Why did they take trouble to know by heart all that stuff when it is all written?
There are merits. Merit is gain.
Merit is gain apart from merit.
Something
on the side of people can
read?
Nearly. Make a guess, please. It's a very heuristic question. Let me tell you one thing again about Vyasa, real or imaginable. Don't forget that when Vyasa knew the whole ideal Vyasa, knew by heart the whole content of the Mahabharata. He knew its content. That is, he knew its content in terms of all the words, verses, prose, poetic lines, prose insertions, explanations. That is, his mind was content and in a way music. Yes.
So they gained a much deeper understanding of it.
No, not necessarily so. But one thing is when you remember the content of the text in terms of words. And quite another thing. When you remember the texts in terms of what? Pages and lines. That is why in Jewish Talmud, in Jewish Bible, in Tibetan Buddhist canon, they print and reprint the works thousands of times. But what? The number of pages is the same, the number of lines is the same, the number of words within the line is the same.